If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver 3 essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist recommended facial moisturizer brand.
Hello, I'm Rob Attar, and this is the second History Extra podcast for July 2012. Coming up in this week's episode, we have...
It was happening in fairly open keys, and it was certainly happening with the knowledge of the customs officers.
That was Evan Jones on smuggling in the Tudor era.
England was a very divided society, and the confrontation and clashes over what people did with their free time on Sundays was a very important part of that.
And that was Alistair Dougal on why sport split society in the 17th century. This podcast is brought to you from the team behind BBC History Magazine, which is Britain's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription, and there are more details of our latest issue and back issues and subscription deals on our website, which, as you may well know by now, is historyextra.com. We are also, of course, available digitally nowadays. You can purchase our Kindle edition direct from the Amazon website, and our iPad edition is available from the Apple newsstand. And if you'd like to find out more about our iPad edition, please visit historyextra.com/iPad. And as usual, we can be found on facebook.com/historyextra and twitter.com/historyextra. So let's begin with a spot of smuggling. Evan Jones, senior lecturer in economic and social history at the University of Bristol, has recently published a book on smuggling in the city during the Tudor period. The magazine's section editor, Charlotte Hodgman, caught up with Evan to find out how the trade in illicit goods boomed during the 16th century.
When we think of smuggling, most of us tend to think of boats landing on deserted beaches in the dead of night, as tended to be the case in Georgian times. But what was different about smuggling in the Tudor era?
Well, in many ways, it was much more open. I mean, it was practiced by sort of major merchants rather than sort of a specialist criminal underclass. And it was able to carry on that way because it was done largely with the complicity of customs officers. So it was much more open. It was less hidden in a way, probably less violent, much more like sort of white collar fraud, or, you know, even some white rough fraud, you might call it, as it's the 16th century.
What does smuggling tell us about Tudor society in general?
Well, I think one of the things it tells us, the fact how prevalent it was, shows just how weak the central state was. I mean, I think we tend to think of sort of Tudor kings and queens like Elizabeth and Henry VIII as being great and all-powerful monarchs. But really, the Tudor state was very weak. It only had about, relied on revenues equivalent to perhaps 1-2% of GDP, relative to over 40% today. And that meant the actual reach of a crown was very limited. It relied very much on local elites to work. And if those local elites were corrupt and conspiring against it, there was actually very little the crown could do.
And was that quite common?
Well, yes. I mean, smuggling was clearly very common. I mean, I've mostly worked on Bristol, but the types of fraud which I see happening clearly around the coast of England. I mean, you sort of pick up sort of stray references or complaints and petitions and so on. It's clear that very similar sorts of activities were happening all over the place.
How was smuggling dealt with if the corruption was so high up in the chain?
With difficulty. In theory, the way the system worked was that you employed customs officers, as you do today, who police the ports, collect revenue and prevent people from lading or unlading goods illicitly. The difficulty was that if those customs officials are corrupt, if they are venal, if they take money payments to look the other way, then it's quite difficult to know where you go from there. And you might say, well, the answer is to appoint honest customs officers, and the Crown, they did figure that out. Yeah. But the trouble was that the way even the appointment of customs officers worked is that it really militated against the appointment of honest men. I mean, this is because to become made a customs officer, you actually had to buy your post from the Lord Treasurer.
Okay.
And a post was treated as a saleable commodity. Once you've used it, you can sell it on to somebody else. But even if you weren't able to do that, but you actually had to buy your post from the Lord Treasurer, if it was like a vacant post. And, basically the Lord Treasurer clearly seemed to have been prepared to accept, those people who paid them the most money for it. Mm. One really good example from Bristol in the 1590s concerns the searchership of Bristol. This is a kind of the main person who's responsible for trying to stop ships from being laded or unladed illicitly. Mm. And there's an application from a noted Bristol privateer, in fact, who wants to be made searcher of Bristol. And he writes to Lord Burghley, the Lord Treasurer, who's also, everyone knows Burghley, he's Elizabeth's main man. Mm. He's the chief minister in the realm. And he offers him £300 to make him the post. Now, this is at a time when an ordinary man will be earning about £10 a year.
It's a lot of money.
It's a huge amount of year. I mean, relative to incomes, it'd be maybe £750,000 in today's money. And that's for a position that has almost no formal wages or salary, and which you, from the small wages and salary you have to pay for the various clerks and deputies and even the customs cutter. Mm. Basically, what it means is that the only way you could actually make this post pay at that sort of price would be if you're corrupt, if you're actually going to be in cahoots with the merchants and allow them to, take bribes for allowing goods to pass.
So that was the attraction of the role?
Well, that was the attraction of the role. That's the only way. I mean, it wasn't just that was an extra benefit. I mean, if you're having to pay this much money for an office, only corrupt men would really be likely to apply for it or have any chance of getting it. And, the people who ultimately were getting rich were Elizabeth's chief ministers. Yeah. And there's one complaint, for instance, in the by Sir Walter Raleigh in the early 17th century, where he claims that Lord Burghley, Sir Francis Walsingham, and Dudley Elizabeth's three chief ministers, were all quote unquote pensioners under the customer of London, who was a guy called Thomas Smith. So what this means is that the customer of London is paying these three most powerful politicians in the country an annual fee to retain his position.
Okay. Were the customs officers quite popular with smugglers then? Because in your feature you mentioned that there was quite a lot of violence sometimes towards the customs officers. Is this the case? Or
You sometimes get violence. On the whole, though, it seems to be handled in a fairly sort of gentlemanly way. I mean, the key thing for the merchants, say the merchants of Bristol, is to use their influence to try to get the right customs officer appointed.
Right, okay.
And from their point of view, the right ones are going to be ones who are going to be favourable to them, ones who are in their pocket. And they spend, quite a lot of time and effort trying to make sure these customs officers remain favourable to them. I mean, there's one example, John Smith at Bristol, who's a powerful Bristol, the richest, most powerful merchant in the 1540s, 1550s. He has a particular relationship with one of a Bristol customs officer, whereby the customs officer has actually started moving into the wine trade. He's a sort of a retail wine merchant. But Smith provides him with lots of wine on credit. I mean, again, it's huge amounts of money. It's at that time, I think it's about £300-400. Sometimes he gets into debt with Smith. So there's a clear conflict of interest here.
Yeah.
That the customs officer knows that if he goes and searches Smith's ship and sees his goods, then any time he wants, Smith can actually reclaim his credit and say, OK, and actually potentially get him thrown into debtor's prison for, you know, for not paying. His credit terms always, he's very generous with his credit terms. He doesn't charge any interest, but he does say in his credit terms that the money is to be paid, quote, at all times. That means that, you know, Smith can claim his money back whenever he wants. So he's got basically this customs officer, who's the key man as far as he's concerned, you know, sort of by the ear.
What were the types of goods that were being smuggled?
Early on, I mean, this large, well, sort of smuggling trade, which I'm looking at, it seems to develop from about the 1520s. Mm. Early on, it's mostly the export of foodstuffs. Now, this is because, although formal customs duties are quite low, from about the 1520s, the Crown gets very concerned that it's inflation means that its ability to raise revenue from overseas trade is actually not keeping up with inflation. And the Crown starts coming up with all sorts of wheezes to try to get more money out of merchants. And one of the things it does, it can't raise customs revenue because it has to go to Parliament for that, and Parliament will always say no. Mm. So what it does, it uses its prerogative right to regulate trade to extract money from merchants. So what it does, for instance, it says, we prohibit the export of all foodstuffs. And the nominal reason for this is they're concerned about food price rises at home. But they say we prohibit the export of foodstuffs. But if you want, you can then buy a license off us, which will allow you to export these goods anyway.
Okay.
So that's about the Crown using its power to control cases. So you first of all ban it, and then you offer licenses. But these licenses are very expensive. They can add 50-60% to the cost of a good, so equivalent to a 60% tax or VAT, if you like. And that creates an incentive for merchants to smuggle the goods instead. So you start off really in the 15, well, as early as 1516 with a real incentive to smuggle foodstuffs. Yeah. But then later on, say in 1538, you start getting, the Crown does the same thing with exports of leather goods and leather, which is a major export item. So again, there's incentives to smuggle that. And then really, finally, in about 1558, in Queen Mary's reign, a series of, well, two major new impositions are put on. These are sort of extra parliamentary taxes, which are levied on the import of wine and the export of broadcloth. Now, this is most important English import and most important export.
Yeah.
And, you know, the duty on wine, for instance, increases 1,700% in a single year. So it goes up from it being equivalent to a 2% tax to about a 40% tax. Mm. And, suddenly, again, therefore, it becomes worth smuggling wine, and so merchants do. And if you look at, say, the Bristol customs accounts of that period, you'll find imports of wine, or declared imports of wine, suddenly falling by about two-thirds. But what's kind of clearly happening is that merchants are actually just smuggling most of their wine now.
Do you think Bristol's typical of the rest of the country in terms of its smuggling activity?
Bristol is particularly well documented, which is why I worked on it, in particular because of a survival of private records, records of smugglers who were never really caught, but it's their own activities. But no, I don't think it's unusual. I mean, Bristol was the second in most important realm in the country at this time. But, you know, the biggest port is by far London.
Mm.
And there's certainly evidence of various types of illicit activity going on in London. Can also see activity in other places in the southwest, in Southampton, in London, I would say in King's Lynn, in Hull. I mean, it's clearly going on around the country. I mean, it's the same. I mean, it varies from port to port.
Yeah.
I mean, different ports have different goods, slightly different trades. Some things might help them to do fraud one way or another. But, you know, the basic patterns seem to be pretty much the same throughout. You know, throughout this period.
And the actual kind of action of smuggling the goods in, was that kind of done secretly? It sounds like it was all quite open. Was that actually the case?
Typically where it happens, say in Bristol, is that, I mean, Bristol is 6 miles up the River Avon from the Severn Estuary.
Yeah.
And typically what would happen is that a ship, say, which is engaged in export smuggling, would go to a customs house, which is in the centre of Bristol, declare some it's a goods which it's going to declare. Mm. Then the ship would sail downriver to Avonmouth, into the River Severn, and then often they would wait there, sometimes taking on extra crew and cargo. Well, not cargo, extra crew and supplies. And during that period, the say a Bristol merchant would send a rider up to upriver warehouses at places like Newnham, Gatcombe, Littleton, up towards Gloucester. Mm. And then they would have their supplies of goods like grain and leather dispatched on river barges. They'd come down the river and rendezvous with a ship. They'd laid the goods on board and they'd sail off. Okay. So it wasn't happening directly under the eyes of people, and sometimes it clearly did happen at night. But on the other hand, it was happening in fairly open keys, and it was certainly happening with the knowledge of the customs officers. But then they paid the customs officers not just to look the other way, but actually often protect their ships from other people who might come and, like, sort of common informers who might come and try to seize the goods.
And what happened to those people who were caught smuggling?
To be honest, really not a lot.
It doesn't sound like, you know.
They were... Even when people are caught, usually the maximum penalty which they might be subject to is that the goods will be seized and they'll be declared forfeit by the Crown. In practice, the merchants have loads and loads of different games they can play to try to minimise their losses. First of all, often the customs officers, if information's been reported to them, will simply, you know, tell the merchant that they're going to come and search for ship, so the ship can try to sail off first.
Okay.
If for some reason it looks like that someone is going to seize a common informer, maybe he's come by and they want to seize the ship, what the merchants will often do is get a friend to go and arrest the ship first.
Right.
And this might seem like a really odd thing to do, but what you do is you get your friend to come along, arrest the ship in the name of the king because it's doing something illicit. Mm. And once you've done that, that means that nobody else can come and arrest the ship because it's already been arrested once. Then your friend goes and initiates an action in the Exchequer Court in London, which is essentially a private prosecution, reporting some form of nonsensical illicit activity on the ship.
Yeah.
The ship, the goods then go into sort of, the ship will then be prosecuted, and then the friend will go and withdraw the charge or allow it to be disproved and say, oh, yes, I was wrong. It was, and then at that point, the case ends.
Okay.
And the vast majority of cases which go before the Exchequer either end because they're abandoned by the informant or some other party, or, you know, the goods probably get valued for a tiny proportion of their true value.
Mm.
Because another thing which merchants will do is that even if goods are seized, they will then say, actually, the seized goods are worth much more than they actually really are worth. So, I mean, and I have one good example of a Bristol ship, which gets valued at £42 when it is seized. But then, by chance, the merchant, who is also the MP for Bristol, dies. This is in 1558. He dies probably of flu, influenza. It's a big influenza outbreak at the time. He dies, and appropriate inventory is created, which actually appropriate inventory is written just a couple of days after the official government inventory takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it clear the ship is actually worth £133 rather than £42. But the merchant, it's the executor to the merchant, had played various games to make sure that it was undervalued in the books.
Okay, all right. So there's no evidence of anyone actually being sort of put in prison or anything like that?
Almost never do people actually get put in prison or anything, you know, really. So I say really the worst thing that's likely to happen is the forfeiture of your goods. But even there, the merchants can... I mean, one of the problems with this system of private prosecution is that informers had an incentive to seize the ship because they were allowed to have 50% proceeds of a seizure. But that still means that in the very worst case scenario, what a merchant can do, that if goods are seized by a common informer, which occasionally happens, then they can go to the informer and offer them a bribe of, say, 50% or 51% to withdraw the action, and then they'll do so. So almost the worst thing that's likely ever to happen is that half the value of the goods will be declared. And there's all sorts of ways in which, if once you've got a private system of prosecution, there's all sorts of ways in which that can be open to abuse. And, you know, got the records to show that merchants abuse it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the stories in your feature that I liked was one of the smugglers actually became mayor of somebody. Do you want to tell us a little bit about him?
Well, they all became it's not unusual. I mean, that particular instance, I think, related to Francis Shackston,
yeah,
who was a smuggler in King's Lynn, who then, even after being, you know, a fairly unusual case, even after being caught and prosecuted and ended up having to admit to various types of illicit activity. Yes, he was mayor. He was made mayor of King's Lynn in about, I think it was 1560. But if I look at, say, my merchants in Bristol, I mean, using the account books of these merchants who are also smugglers, I was able to identify 15 merchants who were engaged in major smuggling activities in the city. Of those, at least 12 of them, I think, served as mayors, sheriffs, or MPs of the city of Bristol at some point or another.
Yeah.
Some of them were all three posts at different times. One was a chamberlain of the city, another was the treasurer of the Royal Navy. So these are very powerful, well-connected men.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the sort of people we're dealing with. They're not fly-by-night cowboys. Mm. I mean, John Smith used his fortune to establish an estate outside of Bristol, the Ashton Court estate, and his family continued to be one of the senior sort of gentry families around the Bristol region until the mid-20th century.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
That was Evan Jones of the University of Bristol. You can read Evan's feature on Tudor smuggling in our July issue. Evan's book, Inside the Illicit Economy, Reconstructing the Smuggler's Trade of 16th Century Bristol, has recently been published by Ashgate. Alistair Dougall is author of The Devil's Book, Charles I, The Book of Sports and Puritanism in Tudor and Early Stuart England, which is published by the University of Exeter Press. His book explores how sport and Puritanism clashed in the run-up to the Civil War, and he's written a piece about that in the July issue of BBC History magazine. The magazine's publisher and former editor, Dave Musgrove, spoke to him recently and began by asking how important sport was in the 17th century.
It had long been an important part of English society, going right back to the early medieval period. Because Sunday, holy days as well, were the only opportunities most people had for any time of leisure. And so they took full advantage of that. So after they'd been to church, the church service, that was an opportunity then to dance, drink and make merry. And that included playing all sorts of different sports, so wrestling, running, all sorts of things. And it was very much an integral part of English life. And that was still the case in the 17th century, although in parts of the country it had declined, and there were reasons for that, religious reasons, but also reasons, concerns over order and disorder. But for many people, and in fact in the 17th century in many ways, for many people where these sports were still current, it was even more important, because with the post-Reformation England, many of the holy days no longer existed. They'd been reduced in number. So Sunday was very much the day of leisure, the one opportunity to have a good time, basically.
Mm. So, yeah, so, I mean, the Reformation is clearly an important marker here, which we perhaps should mention. So that fundamentally changed the landscape of, yeah. of English British society. Well, English in this respect. And that would have been 100 years or so before our story takes off. So how does the how does sport differ between the period before the Reformation and the period after the Reformation?
That's a good question. I think in those areas where people were still practicing their sports on Sunday, I don't think it had changed at all. I think if you look at what people were enjoying and playing in the 17th century before the English Civil War, it was very much the same as they'd been playing and enjoying in the medieval period. Archery was what the authorities wanted the men of England to be doing after church on Sundays, because traditionally that was obviously to keep them fit for warfare, but also the longbow was very important in terms of English history, you know, Cressy, Agincourt and all this sort of thing. By the 17th century, of course, that mattered far less. I mean, they were using muskets and guns and cannon. So actually, in real terms, archery didn't matter that much. But because of the myths surrounding archery and England's history, it was still regarded as important. But the authorities always found it difficult to actually get men just to play archery, because it was an opportunity to do lots of other things. So they played so many other sports, and those hadn't really changed. So you get people, you know, vaulting, sort of jumping over, often a horse, but jumping on or over an object, dancing, and that's mixed dancing, men and women. And wrestling was very popular. Also, ones which went to be legal, such as on Sundays anyway, such as bull and bear baitings, bowling, which might seem odd for people today, that the authorities didn't want the ordinary people to indulge in bowling. But that's because so many of these sports, and bowling is one of them, were occasions of gambling, that people gamble on, you know, who was going to win, and the authorities were very worried that people would, if they lost heavily, would then steal from their masters and so on. But the sports were played in the 17th century hadn't really changed. What had to change was the attitudes to the idea of people playing sports on Sundays, either for religious reasons or for concern about order.
Okay. So we just in terms of the word sport, we're sort of bandying that about here, and is it in any way the same word as we would recognise today?
Not in the same way, I think, in the sense that it's, you know, there wouldn't be so many rules, and a lot of the games would be recognisable. I mean, there were early forms of, some early forms of cricket. There were various things that they would call collectively club ball, but sports involving hitting a ball with a bat or a club, and stool ball was another early form of cricket. Also, cambuc was an early form of golf, but football, I mean, we'd recognise it in the sense it was kicking a ball around, or bladder, you know, around, but it was very, very different, because you didn't, teams of, well, there wasn't any particular team of any particular size. It could involve lads playing football who were in the same village, or it could be a match against another village, in which case it could be played over several fields, and very few rules, very hard-hitting, lots of injuries and fatalities as well. So we recognisable in the sense it's lads kicking a ball around, but not recognisable in terms of no fixed rules, and it was just a question of who got the ball to a particular target first.
And was there ever any, like, it was never organised in any way, I presume, you know, you mentioned like a village might play another village, how would that have been structured? Would the local village elders have said, right, they we're going to have a game?
They would agree that on this particular, and it might well be Shrove Tuesday, actually. It wasn't always Sunday. Shrove Tuesday was a typical day when the tradition they would play football. So they would agree that we're going to hold a match against another team. There were organised games, and one such is the Cotswold Olympics, which was started off by Robert Dover, probably in 1612. But the Cotswold Olympics is unusual in that, but that was an organised annual event where there were particular games, particular rules. A race might be started off. They built a temporary castle, wooden castle, which was known as Dover's Castle after the Robert Dover, who started the games, and the cannon would be fired from these this castle to signify the start of a race and so on. So they were organised, but your typical sport or recreations, sports and pastimes played on Sundays in a parish. There weren't often many rules as such.
Tell me more about the Cotswold Olympics then. So, is this the first instance of something being called Olympics subsequent to the ancient Olympics?
As far as I'm aware, yes, and certainly in this country, yeah. And I think actually anywhere in the world after the. Ancient Greek Olympics. It was started off, as I say, probably in 1612. We're not exactly sure. It might have been a little earlier than that, but probably 1612. And they probably took the place of some traditional church ale, which most parishes would hold an ale or a wake of some kind. So it was an opportunity just to get together and drink and often raise money for the church or something, but then play sports. And Robert Dover, he was a lawyer. Lived near Chipping, Camden, which is the site of the games, and he, possibly because he wanted to keep men fit, had an interest in that, fit for war, or equally just to get people to come together, because these events had been communal events and opportunities for hospitality and for the poor to mix with the gentry as well. We're not sure why he decided to start these games, but he. Decided to make an annual event, which he called his Olympics, the Cotswold Olympics, where they would have all sorts of sports, wrestling, the throwing of the sledge, which is like sledgehammer, throwing the hammer, running, horse racing, all sorts of things. But it was like an Olympic Games in the sense that people did participate in a variety of games. It was organised. And it was an annual event. And they had people playing it I'm not 100% sure, but in Grecian sort of style robes, playing harp and so on. And at the end of the games, too, there'd be a big firework display. So they had their own sort of closing ceremony.
Right. So you've alluded to the contentious nature of sport already. So we need to get on to this. So how did sport become a matter of contention in the 17th century?
That's a very good question. Really, the answer is in two parts. It's partly because of religion and partly because of concerns over order and disorder. As far as that is concerned, the latter, during the 16th century particularly, the latter part of the 16th century, early part of the 17th century, there was a lot of poverty. And the 1590s were a very troubled decade. The economy was suffering, was high unemployment, and people were very concerned about the poor and vagrancy. And of course, there was a very different attitude to the poor then, in that they were at fault somehow. It's because they were lazy and so on. And people were very worried. The authorities, JPs, the gentry, were very worried about people being idle. And so that was one thing. The other was that actually many of these occasions of sport, when people did get together, they would brew ale and so on. And there would be a lot of drinking, and often things would get out of hand. So they were right to be concerned in some cases in terms of disorder. Quite often at wakes and ales, when these sports and recreations would be enjoyed, fighting would break out and you could get fatalities and so on. So there was a concern about that, an arising concern about social order and what to do with people, what people would do in their free time. But added to that, during the late 16th century, you've got the emergence of Puritanism. So these are people in the Church of England, but who were radical Protestants and wanted to change both the church, that became more Protestant as far as they were concerned, but also society. And as part of that, they wanted Sunday, the Lord's Day, to be devoted entirely to God, so that people not only attend church, but after church, rather than indulge in the sports and recreations that they would traditionally enjoy after church, they should spend the day praying, reading the Bible, visiting the sick, and so on. And so there was a clash of ideologies. People who had traditionally enjoyed their sports on Sunday were now faced with attempts to suppress them by JPs who were concerned about issues of social order, and by Puritans, either Puritan ministers, some cases Puritan JPs, who wanted to suppress them because they wanted them to make them devote the day entirely to God.
And into that debate, surprisingly, wades monarchy?
Yeah.
Why? How?
Elizabeth I, who was the monarch really, she was on the throne when Puritans really began to emerge, and Puritanism for the mainstream church and church hierarchy began to become a real problem. Elizabeth I herself enjoyed traditional sports, and she herself she danced in May Games. She'd even allowed wrestling once in the Royal Chapel. So it's quite clear what she thought about sports, and it was also clear what she thought about the Puritans. But she wisely decided that she wouldn't make any formal declaration about it. When James I came to the throne, he came from Scotland, where he'd been king for many years, and he had a very troubled upbringing in many ways. And at one point he was kidnapped, and he was under the control of certain Scottish nobles who were themselves very radically Protestant, and stopped sports and dances and so on. So he had that sort of background, and he certainly had no love of the Puritans. And I think as his reign went on, he saw the Puritans as a greater threat than Catholicism, which of course was the other potential threat to the mainstream Church of England. And when he was passing through Lancashire on his way back from a visit to Scotland, he was petitioned by some ordinary men and women from Lancashire whose sports were being suppressed. There were Puritan JPs, magistrates, who had issued an order banning the playing of sports and recreations on Sunday. So they stopped the king, petitioned him. And he then issued a declaration in which he made it clear that they did have the license to play certain sports after church on Sundays. Provided they'd been to church first, they could take part in various activities. And I think he did that partly in answer to their petition, but also as an opportunity to put the Puritans back in their place, because I think he was getting increasingly frustrated by Puritan attempts to speak out on how the church should be run when he was head of the church.
But I mean, presumably this was a populist policy. You know, that's the equivalent of George Osborne not putting more tax on petrol. That's something that the common man would think, yes, I
absolutely
agree.
And in many parts of the country it was greeted as such. Mm. I mean, initially he published it just for Lancashire. Lancashire was the most Catholic county. It had more Catholics concentrated in Lancashire than anywhere else. And one of the reasons he gave for issuing the declaration was that he was worried that if Catholics were stopped from playing sports on Sundays, they might associate that with the Church of England, and see and therefore it would make it less likely for them to convert. But the following year he issued it for the whole country, and it was greeted in many places very warmly, because they thought, at last, now we've got license to continue the sports that we want to, and we can put the Puritan JPs back in their place. However, many others, obviously if they were Puritan, but many others as well, were concerned about the license that seemed to be given to debauchery or drunkenness on the Lord's Day, because I think by the time James issued his declaration, the debate had slightly moved on, and in some ways I think the Puritans had not won the argument, but persuaded a greater proportion of the English people that the church wasn't Protestant enough. So there were many people who weren't Puritans, but who were still troubled by the license given to playing sports and drinking and so on Sunday. But James, quite prudently, when he realised that there was a degree of opposition in certain quarters, including from his own Archbishop, because Archbishop George Abbott, whilst not a Puritan, had some Puritan sympathies, and certainly he wasn't sort of high church. And he himself didn't like the idea of the Book of Sports, which is what James's declaration became known as, being read out from the pulpit. And the idea was that it would be published, and it would be published from the pulpit. And when James realised that there was some opposition to that, he decided, in fact, just to turn a blind eye. So he made his declaration, he made his statement, but he didn't then enforce it. And that changed under Charles I, because his son, Charles I, was a very, very different man, a different person, and he wanted to have such things enforced.
Just backtracking a little bit, we're talking about England fairly specifically here, but you've mentioned Scotland and the fact that James obviously came from Scotland. Mm. Charles I was born in Scotland. Mm. Was the situation completely different in Scotland? Were the same debates being had?
The same debates were being had, but I think to a large extent the debate of those in favour of recreation and dancing and so on had been lost in Scotland, because the Scottish Church was much more radical. And James, I mean, there was an instance where the local authorities in Edinburgh tried to ban some minstrels from playing on a Sunday in Edinburgh, and the King intervened because they were actually minstrels who had come from England, and the King intervened because he wanted to allow them to play, and he didn't want the Kirk telling him what to do. But most people in Scotland were far more radically Protestant, and I think that Puritan Sabbatarianism, this idea that Sunday should be devoted entirely to God, had taken hold much more readily in Scotland and was much more widespread. So, but that was the background that James had, if that makes sense.
Sure. And presumably the situation in Wales was broadly similar to England, given the political ties.
Yes. Well, in fact, Wales, places like Wales and Cornwall, I mean, the southwest of England, that's where, in many cases, these traditional, you know, the wakes and ales, these traditional festivities had remained very popular. It was really in the parts of the country where Protestantism had deeper roots and where Puritanism was beginning to take hold, so the southeast of England, London and so on, that's where traditional Sunday recreations were already being suppressed. But in places like Wales, the north of England, where you still had a lot of Catholics, and the southwest, that's where you still had much more of this traditional festivity, and it's in those parts of the country where the Book of Sports was welcomed.
And across the water in Ireland, is that a completely different situation?
Obviously that was still largely Catholic. I mean, you had in the northern part of Ireland, of course, there'd been the plantations. You did have Protestants there, and a lot of them had come over from Scotland. So those radical Protestants would have shared the same views as their English Puritan counterparts or the Scottish Presbyterians. But in the vast bulk of Ireland, it was still Catholic, and so they would be wedded still to their traditional culture and festivities.
All these areas, all these countries were engulfed in war in the middle of the 17th century.
Yeah.
And how far was sport in any way involved in that? It seems like a silly question to ask.
No, I don't think it's a silly question to ask at all. I mean, I think fundamentally the English Civil War, which remains the worst conflict our country's ever experienced. And I think people forget that because we don't have any film footage, we don't have any sort of grandparents or great-grandparents who lived through something like the First World War or the Second World War. It's very easy to lose sight of the fact the English Civil War was a terrible conflict. I mean, when you think that, I think it's 0.6% of the population died in the Second World War, 1.6 in the First World War. In the English Civil War, it's 3.6%, so a much higher proportion. Obviously, a numerically much smaller number because the population was tiny compared, but had a huge impact. And that war had a number of causes. Obviously, there were political causes. Religion played a big part. But I think that cultural and issues and festivity and different attitudes to sports did play their part. I think the King came to be seen by royalists not only as defending the established church, but many of them also defending their traditional way of life. Many of them, in different parts of the country, had already experienced Puritan magistrates, Puritan ministers trying to suppress their traditional way of life. And they knew full well that if Parliament under the control of the likes of Pym and so on, the Puritans, won the war, then that would be under attack as never before, as it proved, because obviously they did lose the war, and Cromwell's government did suppress sports. It became illegal to have play sports on Sundays during the entire period of the Republic. And there's lots of evidence that to suggest that people recognised that. I'm not suggesting for a moment that was the motivation for everyone, or indeed the majority, but for some, certainly I think it was. And there's evidence from parliamentary propaganda at the time where they specifically say in some things like Mercurius Britannicus, where they say that the people who make up the King's army are the people who practiced debauchery or May games and so on Sundays, who went to wakes and ales. So they identify them as joining the King's army. And whilst there are a few examples of some people who supported the suppression of sports, who then nonetheless fought for the king. And there are examples of some people who indulged in sports on Sunday who fought with Parliament. They're very much the exception. The vast majority of people who came out in support of festivity and so on were royalist.
Mm. And am I right in remembering that it was Charles I reissued the Book of Sports and sort of inflamed passions in so doing?
Absolutely. In 1633, Charles issued a slightly amended version of his father's declaration. But Charles's Book of Sports was different in the sense that he was determined to have it enforced. So he insisted that it should be read out from every pulpit in every parish. And that in the face of really considerable opposition. And a number of ministers in different parts of the country were suspended or lost their livings for not doing so, for refusing to do so. But he did that at the time when there was no parliament. He did that during his personal rule. From 1629 to 1640, he was ruling without a parliament. And although some brave people did speak out against the Book of Sports, there was very little overt opposition to it, other than a number of ministers refusing to read it because it was against their conscience to do so. But when he was forced to call a parliament again in 1640 to raise an army to tackle with the rebellion in Scotland, MPs then seized their opportunity, the first opportunity they'd had since its publication some years before, to speak out against it. And so it's quite clear that it wasn't an issue that had gone away. And during the short parliament and then again the long parliament, the issue of recreations on Sunday, May games, the use of maypoles and so on, came up again and again. Parliament then issued ordinances banning the use of maypoles, banning Sunday recreations. It did become an issue where people were very clear about where Parliament stood and where the King stood.
Sure. So, in some, it's a very useful window into society in that first half of the 17th century. Then it opens us up to all these themes that you've just outlined.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it involves national politics. It involves local politics as well, as in the case in Lancashire. And there was a similar instance with Charles down in Somerset. But it absolutely does, because it touches on questions of order and disorder. It touches on obviously who had control of the church and people's traditional way of life, which was certainly. They were right to see it as under attack, and it was under attack. And that fed into the tensions and the divisions that ended up in the English Civil War. Because Charles's England was a very divided society, and the confrontation and clashes over what people did with their free time on Sundays was a very important part of that. And his publication of the Book of Sports and the reaction to it only served to increase those divisions.
How does the story end? After the Civil War and the Restoration, Charles II coming back, does the situation normalise somewhat and people start playing sports again and the debate sort of dissolve?
Absolutely. I think things were slightly different in the sense that in the medieval and medieval period and then during the 16th century and to a lesser extent perhaps but some extent the early 17th century ales and wakes had been used to raise money. By the time of Charles II's restoration parishes they were relying more on the parish rates and so on, so you don't find ales and wakes being revived in every part of the country, but they are revived. Charles II himself, of course, was restored in May, and so May games, which had been so popular before the Civil War in many parts of the country, were once again revived and very much linked now to the monarchy and to Charles II. And indeed, they had a maypole and Morris dancing in the procession through London when he came back and was restored to the crown. And the Cotswold Olympics, for example, Robert Dover's Olympics, which had been suppressed in 1643 when the Civil War was well underway, they were then revived. We're not exactly sure whether it was 1660, 61 or 62, but shortly after the Restoration, the Cotswold Olympics were themselves revived. Sadly for Robert Dover, he died in 1652, so he didn't live to see them revived. But very much in parts of the country, you saw a revival of sports on Sunday. And really the debate was over until really the 19th century, when Sabbatarianism became an issue again, and the likes of Eric Liddell running in on a Sunday and so on. It became an issue again with the Victorians about how Sundays should be observed. But from the Restoration to the 19th century, in part those parts of the country where traditional festivities were still valued, they were revived in one form or other.
That was Alistair Dougal. Alistair teaches history at the Godolphin School in Salisbury. You can read a feature by him on sport and the civil wars in our July issue. And indeed, if the civil wars are your thing, then the main feature in the July edition is an examination of the key events in the 17th century conflict as chosen by Blair Warden, John Adamson and Michal Oshakru. Well, that's about it for this episode. Next week we'll be chatting about suffragettes and medieval travellers, so do please join us for that. In the meantime, please keep an eye on our website, historyextra.com, for blogs, quizzes, galleries and more. And don't forget, you can find our Kindle edition and iPad editions on the Amazon website and Apple newsstand respectively. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Dave Gibson. We'll be right back.